Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. The government has finally produced its reforms to Senate voting, only months before the election, whether that is a normal election or a double dissolution. The essence of the changes is that it would make it nearly impossible for micro players, parties or most independents, to get elected or re-elected to the Senate. Micro players have, of course, been key balance of power players who have often frustrated this coalition government. The government held back the legislation because it knew there would be a backlash from crossbench senators. And now that reaction has come. Today we talk with the Liberal Democratic Senator David Leinhelm about the changes and what they will mean for parties like his. Senator Leinhelm, you got into the Senate with quite a strong vote, around 9%, but that was because of a huge dose of luck. You were number one on the ticket, and also many people confused your party's name with the Liberals. Will your party survive when these changes come in?
I don't accept both those propositions. There's certainly a certain amount of luck involved in being first on the ticket. Everybody wants to be first on the ticket because of the donkey vote factor. In every election, it's worth at least 1%. And when there are 45 parties on the ballot paper, being first on the ticket is especially valuable and it was probably worth more than 1%. I don't accept the proposition that my vote was attributable to confusion. I'm not saying absolutely nobody was confused, but there were 450,000 people who voted for them. And the only person whose vote I know for sure was deliberately for me was mine. And as far as I'm aware, they're all secret ballot votes, and it's pure speculation to argue that 450,000 or 449,000 or whatever what it was were confused. But as to my vote in a future election, that's very hard for a small party to predict. We've had by-elections where we've got as high as 13% of the vote, and we've had other by-elections where we've got as small as 0.5% of the vote. For us to know what our vote might be if I was the candidate, and I have a profile, I did have a profile in 2013 as well, because I have been writing for Fairfax Rural Media for many, many years, so I did have a profile of my own. What would my vote be personally? Hard to know. What would our vote, the party vote, be if I wasn't the candidate? Hard to know. I do think under a double dissolution scenario, we would stand a good chance of getting elected. Under a normal half-Senate election, I think it would be very, very difficult. And the difference is that a normal half-Senate election, under the rules that the government is intending to introduce, we would require a primary vote with no preferences, and preferences will probably be almost irrelevant, of about 10%. In a full double dissolution, that's halved, so about 5%. 5% is achievable, 10% it would be a hell of a stretch.
Now, we've heard a lot about the problems of the system being gamed through so-called preference whispering, working out a ticket where one of the small parties gets elected and no one ever quite knows which one will be the case. Was your party involved in this preference whispering in 2013?
Again, I don't accept the premise of that question. There's nothing whispering about negotiating preferences. It's called an exhaustive preferential system, which, and the purpose of it is so that if you vote for a particular candidate and that candidate does not get elected, then your vote is not wasted. It then goes on to benefit your next preferred candidate, and then your next one after that, and your next one after that, and you may end up electing your 21st favourite candidate.
But the individual voter doesn't determine that if they vote above the line.
If they vote above the line, that's quite right. It's subject to the party determining what's in the best interests of the party rather than the voter, and that's quite right. So the question is, who's got better judgment, the individual voter or the party. They do have the option, of course, of voting below the line. And a lot of people do, especially those who are sort of more switched on politically. In Victoria, you don't have to vote for all the candidates below the line in the Legislative Council elections there. You can vote one above the line and leave the preferences to the party, or you can vote below the line for just as many candidates as there are places to be filled, or you can go further. So, for example, if you just like two parties, you can vote for those two and then stop below the line if you want to, and you have full control over your preferences and you don't have to fill in every box. That seems to me to be a perfect compromise between those who don't trust the party to allocate preferences. If you trust the party to allocate your preferences, then you can vote one above the line. But we're not going to get that system, unfortunately.
In a way, it's a bit ironic, isn't it? Because if the preference whispering had not been so successful at the last election, then we mightn't have these changes upon us.
Yes, I suppose that's one way to look at it. If the preference negotiations had produced a different outcome, I think that would not have prompted the government to do what it's done. The thing is, though, 2004 we had Steve Fielding elected in Victoria on 1.9%. In 2010 we had John Madigan elected on 2.3%. Then in 2013 we had Ricky Muir elected on less than 0.5%. So it's Ricky Muir's election that's really prompted it, theoretically. Now, I got 9.5% of the vote. The PUPs all got 6, 7, and I think 12% in the case of Dio Wang in Western Australia. Bob Day got 3.5% in South Australia. All pretty robust votes, primary votes I'm talking about here. So we're not talking about tiny percentages, except in the case of Ricky Muir in the 2013 election, and we have the two previous examples of Steve Fielding and John Madigan. So you really can't say that all of a sudden the minor parties have woken up to how the system has worked and have manipulated it to the disadvantage of the voters. Certainly they've worked out how the system works to their own advantage, and that's not to the advantage of the Liberal Party and the Labor Party. But you can't say that all of a sudden, you know, they know how to work the system better than the Liberals and the Labor Party do. What has prompted this is the fact that the government is appallingly bad at dealing with the crossbench, has been right from the start. I have been complaining about it constantly over the last 18 months. And rather than get better at it, rather than learn how to do it properly, rather than learn from each other so that they share with each other how to negotiate with each of the crossbench, and I do fully concede that some on the crossbench are legitimately described as feral. They're a bit irrational. They don't behave in the way you would expect a professional politician to behave.
Could we name names here?
No, we can't name names here. I have to deal with these individuals. But some of them, I admit, would be difficult to deal with from the government's point of view. But nonetheless, they do not share their knowledge and understanding of how to deal with any of us as a crossbench. They all like me because they like my small L liberal principles. But they find me easy to talk to, but then they basically give up on several of the crossbench. Now, rather than learn how to do it, rather than take a leaf out of Labor's book, when Labor had a hung lower house in the previous government under the Gillard government, and they had to deal with the crossbench and get stuff through, and were highly successful at it, highly successful. You can quibble about whether the legislation they passed was good or not, but they got it through. They learned how to handle a crossbench. This government has not learned how to handle a crossbench, and instead of learning, instead of figuring out what's going to work, they basically said, the hell with it, we're going to throw the cards up in the air and see if we can do better. And by the way, we're going to change the rules at the same time.
But Malcolm Turnbull surely said he was reaching out to the crossbench. Are you saying that he wasn't much more successful or much more inclusive than Tony Abbott?
We never heard from him after the first week. When he was first elected, he was in touch with us all. He's a nice guy. I quite like him at a personal level. very affable. He can be very charming. But we never heard from him. So whatever benefits there were associated with him becoming the Prime Minister, and there was a reservoir of goodwill, especially relative to Tony Abbott, when he first became Prime Minister. You know, there, we had a crossbench meeting, I think the day he took over, and I think we were all there, or nearly all of us, probably not Nick. And I sort of tested attitudes in the room, and there was a reservoir of goodwill. There was a feeling that, well, things have changed, maybe we'll get on better with the government now. There was no follow-up, no continuation of that. They did change who liaised with us. The government became a little bit better about telling us what they intended to do.
You mean which senator liaised?
Senator Brandis was a little bit better at telling us what was being planned.
Than Erica Betts?
Yes. They kind of took a new approach. And
But the Prime Minister did not make any further contact?
No. We all got a phone call from him, which was a good start. In that first week, and that was it. That's the end of it.
So you think that he could have got more legislation through in these last few months if he'd been more activist himself?
Yes, there were two things that were needed. One was for Malcolm himself to have got involved in this and to have used his charms and his powers of negotiation and whatever to have convinced some of my fellow crossbenchers to see it his point of view. The other thing that they could have done and should have done was to lift their game in general at dealing with the crossbench, to have improved the way they liaised with us, and particularly some of the other crossbenchers rather than me, and to have learnt from each other, so when one made a mistake, they didn't go in and repeat the same mistake later because they didn't tell each other, to understand what motivates each of us, and to also understand that there are many, many ways to skin a cat when it comes to negotiating with a crossbench, and they only tried about one of them.
Now, what's going to happen with your attitude and the attitude of your crossbench colleagues to legislation, given that there's been this big falling out with the government?
The way we see it is that this legislation is likely to put minor parties out of business. In a normal half-Senate election, you will need, as I said earlier, 10% of the vote to get elected. That basically makes it impossible for minor parties. Even the Greens will struggle in some states. They don't even get 10%, so they will find it hard in their weakest states. So it's going to come down to the Senate being Liberal, Labor, Liberal and Nats, Greens and Labor. So the minor parties are not going to get much of a look in, with the exception of Xenophon. Now, 25% of the voters in the last election voted for a minor party, that is a party other than the majors, Liberal, Labor and Greens. Vast numbers of votes will exhaust, will go nowhere. There will be some people who will vote for a minor party and then a major party, but I guarantee you vast majority won't. I also know from the experience with the New South Wales upper house elections that it will default to a one above the line choice for vast numbers of people, which will mean that anyone who votes for anyone other than a major party, their vote is likely to be exhausted. So it's going to be a de facto first-past-the-post system. We know that first-past-the-post systems, both in America and the UK, they are undemocratic. The Senate is intended to be proportional representation. It won't be proportional representation under this system.
But just coming back to the here and now, mm-hmm. while you've got power, how are you going to exercise that power? Are you going to be a lot more bolshy on legislation that's coming up?
I'm not anticipating there will be a lot of contentious legislation between now and May. We've only got, a couple more weeks of sittings. I don't think the government's likely to bring on anything other than the ABCC bill.
This is the Australian Building and Construction.
Correct.
Bill, which is about a new watchdog.
Yes,
or a reconstituted watchdog.
That's right, bringing it back again. I'm not expecting there will be a big legislative agenda on which, you know, the votes of the crossbenchers will be all that significant. And that's because there needs to be Labor and the Greens on one side and the government on the other side and the crossbench in the middle.
Well, what about that bill, though? What's been your attitude and what will be your attitude?
My attitude has been to give the government the benefit of the doubt on it and also quite a number of other bills. It offends my libertarian principles considerably. There is a reverse onus of proof component to it, which is obnoxious. There is also a abolition of the right to silence, which is equally obnoxious. So I have plenty of reason on libertarian principles as a Liberal Democrat to vote against it.
And that's what you're inclined to do?
Well, up to recently, that wasn't what I intended to do. I had said to the government, I don't like it. I will have to hold my nose to vote for this. This is a stretch, but it's been the government's... It's something that the government campaigned on at the last election. It was the very first issue that Tony Abbott discussed with me even before I was sworn in. They're very, very committed to it. And the truth is, when the ABCC existed prior to its abolition by the Gillard government, it did actually help to clean up corruption in the building industry. So I was sympathetic to them from that point of view, but still, principles are principles. So I said to them, I'm not going to support this without a sunset clause. I initially met resistance when Erica Betts was in the industrial relations portfolio. After a while, he realised he wasn't going to get the numbers without my support, and for my support, a sunset clause was mandatory. So we negotiated the term, and so up until the introduction of this, or the announcement of this change in the voting system, my position had been I would support it with an 8-year sunset clause on it. I had to hold my nose somewhat to do that, but that was the position I reached. So, you know, I had to give considerable ground on my principles, but I was, you know, going to let the government give the government my vote on it. So the way I see it now, thanks very much, David. Now we're going to change the voting laws. Your party is most unlikely to ever win another seat. And we might even have a double dissolution in which you'll be up for election as well, just 18 months after you've been sworn in. So that's gratitude for you. My inclination now is, well, my principles are my principles. I see no problem with standing by them. So now my position is, give me a reason why I should compromise my principles again.
Of course, the government would like that bill to be part of a double dissolution election if it has one.
Yeah.
And in a way, while a double dissolution is against your interests because your term's cut short, it is in your party's interest, and presumably you will be the candidate again, so I guess the flip side is your interest too, to have a double dissolution, isn't it? Because you require fewer votes to get in.
Yes, we've discussed that. We're a very principled party, so we're not that nakedly ambitious, but yes, you're quite right. A double dissolution would probably be better for us in terms of re-winning a seat. The other way to look at it, though, is if there wasn't a double dissolution and I had another 3 years in which I could remain here and build up a constituency, then there also the other possibility is that by that stage we just might reach 10% of primary vote. So that's the other side of the coin. We're not thinking of it purely in those terms.
Although self-interest seems a pretty popular horse all round in the Senate at the moment.
I have never known self-interest to be absent from anything to do with politics, and no, it's not absent in my case either. I'm continually accused of acting out of self-interest, and I often think, well, who doesn't?
Indeed. Now, the minor parties are warning the government that, and indeed the Greens, that at an election they might run candidates in seats, lower house seats, preference against the government, preference against Adam Band.
Mm-hmm.
But really, is there that much in it for them, because if they're going to be squeezed out of the system, where are they going to get the money? Is the effort worth this sort of revenge politics?
Yes, that's a valid question. It's a matter for the Minor Party Alliance to decide. There's going to be a lot of anger about this, because there are a lot of political parties, a lot have been registered just in the last 12 months. There are a lot of people invested in the system which allows small parties to have a chance of having influence, winning a seat, or at least their preferences influencing government policy. So there's going to be a lot of people who are very angry about this, who are, looking for some way to, strike back. The Minor Party Alliance meeting in a couple of weeks' time will discuss this. I've been asked about this in the media a few times. I am somewhat attracted to it because it gives the coalition reason to think, well, look, this is not a painless process. This is not something that we can do and just say, oh, well, that's tough luck. We've got the numbers. There may be marginal coalition seat holders who lose their seats as a result. This has been prompted by the Greens out of simple self-interest from their point of view too. For Adam Bandt to lose his seat would be satisfying, I suspect, to quite a lot of the minor parties that would be adversely affected by this. It is practical. There are 10 or 15 marginal coalition seats that could be targeted. There's at least 10 or 15 minor parties that could nominate candidates in several of these. If one party, and that's not too expensive if it's spread across a number of parties, one party took one seat, they would, most of them would be able to round up enough volunteers to hand out how to votes, to direct preferences away from the coalition, or in Melbourne away from the Greens. So it is a practical option as to whether or not it will go ahead. I don't know at this point.
Just finally, Malcolm Turnbull has invited the crossbenchers to the lodge on Thursday night, tomorrow night. I wonder whether you're going, and I also wonder how you see this invitation. It could be interpreted as a bit of a poke in the eye, couldn't it? Because he must have known the legislation was coming up this week, even though the invitation was extended a while ago.
Yes, I don't know what the motivation for the dinner and invitation was all about. There must have been some sort of thought to the fact that we might not be in any mood to be convivial. There has been quite a lot of discussion about whether we should go in the corridors of the Senate this week. It's been a range of reactions from stuff him, let's all stay away, to let's all turn up and give him a piece of our mind. I think the latter option is emerging as the consensus.
You're
view.
Planning to go?
Unless everybody else changes their mind between now and tomorrow night, yes, I'll be there.
So it'll be all in or all out, will it?
Pretty much, yes. It does look like, I don't work with Lambie and Lazarus very much, though I find them a bit hard work. But I'm not going to be all that influenced by what they do. But the others, yes, if they're all going, then I'll be going. If they're all out, I'll be out. And at this stage, it does look like they're all in, so I'm in.
What about Nick Xenophon, of course, who's on the other side of this argument?
Yeah, we don't talk to Nick all that much. He's now with the enemy. He's effectively a Green anyway. He votes for the Greens all the time. He votes for the Greens more than Labor does. So we don't... we don't talk to him very much, and he does do his own thing. He stands apart from all of us. When he wants something, he's our best friend, but the rest of the time he's off doing his own thing.
Well, it'll be a very interesting session at the Lodge. David Leinhelm, thank you for talking with us today. That's all from our podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview soon.